Hello, I'm with Bala Jason. Hi, Bala.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. So maybe we could start with how you got into focusing?
Okay, we can start there. It's a long story, but I will shorten it as much as possible. I had a client that I was working with, and she asked me if I knew what focusing was, and I said I'd never heard of it. And she said, that's amazing because that's the way we're working. And so in the next time she came, she brought me the book as a gift, and I read it, and I really flipped out. I felt as if I could have written it myself because it was exactly what I was doing. Of course, I didn't know the language for focusing, but this way of paying attention inside was something I was just naturally doing. So to make a long story short, I contacted Gene and wound up in Chicago and was sitting in his first workshop just smitten with what he was saying, but also as he was going on, I was getting increasingly uncomfortable. And it was, I had been into spiritual work for a long time as a meditator and yoga and all of this, and he kept talking about going down into the body and making friends. That was the killer for me, making friends with these parts you didn't like. And I thought, no, 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 this is not right. You're supposed to transcend these things and be above them. So I thought I would have this very meaningful conversation with him on the break. And so I went up to him to have this meaningful conversation and promptly burst into tears, getting just uncontrollably hysterical and blurted out something really crazy like, you're not supposed to go down, you're supposed to go up, or said just something really nuts like that. And he totally got it. That was what was so, I mean, that's so keen. He just got the whole thing. And of course, that led on to a connection with him and Mary McGuire and my whole time in Chicago, but we had some phenomenal conversations about what it means to transcend and rise up and what it means to go down and pay attention to. And I had a real crisis for some time trying to integrate those two things to really understand, when do you pay attention, when do you rise above it, and that was just a whole meaningful, obviously, meaningful is an understatement, a major transition in my life. So,
yeah,
that story.
it seems like the most extreme contradiction you could find yourself in between going up and going down and trying to make sense of it.
Well, you know the expression that we use in focusing, both and, rather than either or.
Yeah.
And to this day, I think it is a both and. I mean, there's life is the soul and your deepest spiritual principles, and your life is human and what you deal with from day to day, people, frustrations, and you need to know how to pull those together. It really is a both and for me, and sometimes you need to go downstairs, sometimes you need to go upstairs. Sometimes you need to go back and forth real quick, up, down, up, down, up, down,
right.
at least for me.
And finding a container where maybe the distinction between up and down is no longer the same as it used to be from ordinary language. Or
well, hopefully on this journey you integrate at some point where you're kind of living as whatever is your highest presence through your daily life. In other words, that it touches the aspects of your daily life, so that it's woven. I think that's the word that comes when we're talking woven or integratable or both and.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, I like that both and, yeah. So so you went to Chicago to get trained after you discovered that you were actually focusing without really knowing that you were focusing.
Yes, and then many things happened that I guess we just call karma. I developed an amazing relationship with Mary McGuire, and out of that, I had been doing some work as the director of the center up here. I started questioning her about why they were only doing weekend workshops, because after you'd done one or two weekend workshops, there was nothing further to do. And so then I started saying, you know, you should do a week of this or 10 days of it. And I think I can't remember now, but I think our original week long was actually 10 days. I may be wrong about that. I'm not sure, but it certainly was a full week and maybe a day or two more of, pre-something to connect, but it was very full. And, so we developed this whole thing, and the first one we had, I think we had 8 people, and the second one like 25 people, and the third one like 40 people. So the thing really built up. We did it in those days it was twice a year. I think it was August, and we did another one in November. And we did that for a number of years, and at some point in there I got pregnant and had a baby, and flew the nanny down with the baby because I didn't want her to have separation anxiety. So she was part of the week-longs too, and everybody would kid around that she was going to be a natural focuser because she'd been in all the week-longs. And actually she is, so it turned out okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And of course it's been taken on now, continued further, but that was such a special, wonderful period, and we met everybody because there were no coordinators in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So we met, you know, all the people from different countries who are still with us now. But in those early days, they all came down to the week long. That was the only place to go. So it was a very exciting, exciting time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah.
So how did you bring focusing back into your practice?
Well, that part was easy to do because it seemed like I had been doing it even before I knew what it was. So now that I knew what it was clearer and easier to do. And I also started, pulling together courses and training modules and things that I had never done before, because now I had the understanding to do it in so many week-longs behind me as well. And then there was some point, I mean, should I just sort of continue on with the evolution of this?
Yeah, and you know, feel free to, if you know, there is a part where it touches on your life as opposed to work, and there is an interaction and so on. Yeah, in a way, how did focusing...
When you say touches on my life, I can think of one funny story.
Go ahead.
My husband came down with me for one of the earlier trainings that I did. It may have been the first time I ever came to Chicago, and we were visiting other friends in Chicago and made a trip through the Midwest after the training was over. And in those days, it's so funny because Gene would just crack up hearing this. You know, he always says, use focusing anyway, and it's not rigid. But in those days, everybody did the steps, and they did them in order. And there just wasn't, when I say there wasn't the flexibility there is now, we thought we were flexible, but everybody just did these steps, you know. So clearing a space, the way I learned it, took about 20 minutes to do. And my husband was so frustrated because he could never get to working on anything. He spent all his time clearing his space. So he said, I've had it with this thing. So when we came home and I was trying to do it with him, I kept trying to take him through the quickest clearing space I could possibly do so he could get to focusing, not knowing that if something was there, just go for it. You don't have to clear a space. So he got a funny aspect of it, but I guess he does it in his own way, but we don't do it in any formal partnership, he and I. I have my own changes group here, but he's not part of it, I'm sorry to say. So anyway, that I don't know, that took me off track. But
yeah, no, but that gives a very good flavor of what it was, yeah.
It's just we're so flexible now, and we integrate focusing in so many ways, but in the earlier days we wanted to do that, but focusing came first.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now it's like, if it was the body, to me now focusing is like a spine, your spine is always there, but mm-hmm. if you're a runner, you think about your legs, and if you're a swimmer, you think about your arms or your heart rate, but your spine is always there. So for me, focusing now is just there, no matter what else I'm doing.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if that's a good way to put it, but...
Well, to me, what it makes me think of is it's at the time where the spine is discovered, when you don't just take it for granted, you discover it, you're going to be a little bit more conscious of it and a little bit more, formal maybe with it.
Mm-hmm.
Until such a time as you realize that it's not going to go away. It's solid.
It's there and it's, yes, I like that word a lot. It's solid. And I feel like that about focusing, as ethereal as it is, it's solid in its presence, I think, in all of our lives, those of us who do it in a regular way.
Mm-hmm.
So much for that.
So then,
do you want a chronology?
Sure.
Okay, so then I had this woman who was a client of mine, and at some point, since the problem was relational, she asked me if she could bring her husband, and the way she and I worked really worked well with focusing as a major part of how we worked. But when she came with her husband, and it was interactional, number one, and I don't mean interactional in the sense of focusing interactional, I mean just the three people were in the room interacting,
yeah.
And he did not function that way at all. I realized what I knew was not going to meet the needs of these people, and I needed something more. So to make a very long story short, I went back to school for marriage and family therapy, and in that training you learn about all the different kinds of marriage and family therapy because there's so many different models, and one of them was under the rubric of brief therapy. And as soon as I started reading about it, I just knew it was a little like focusing. There was something there for me
mm-hmm.
that was so right. And so I, when I graduated from that program, I then went into a clinical extern program in brief therapy, in which that's all we did. There are many models just under the umbrella of brief mm-hmm. therapy, and I was particularly smitten with a couple of them, especially into Kim Berg's work. But the important thing was that, I don't know quite how to say this, it's like brief therapy was exactly like focusing in some way, but at another level. I mean, it's like, you know, when Jean talks about taking the elevator,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, oh my God, this is like on a different floor. It's the same. I had my image came was, you know, when you go to a hotel and when you get off this elevator, all of the hallways are the same no matter what floor you're
mm-hmm.
on.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, so focusing is on the third floor and brief therapy is on the eighth floor, but when you get to the end of the hall, there's a window and it's the same view, but on the eighth floor, it's the top of the trees, and on the third floor, it's the trunk or something. But it's the same.
Yeah.
And it was like that. I just kept seeing these parallels because they're both, when I say solution-focused, I mean it now in the broadest sense. They're both solution-focused rather than problem-focused.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talk about problems in focusing, but we're always looking for what's right, what's fresh air, how would it be if it was right, what does it need?
Yeah.
Solution asks the same exact questions in a different kind of way, but they're the same exact questions. And so this was, for me, the most thrilling. That program was so thrilling for me, and it was also a little quiet joke because nobody in that training knew anything at all about experiential work. Because brief therapy comes out of social work, and focusing comes out of psychology, and social work and psychology are really two different training programs. So nobody knew or understood what I was into, and I had to restrain myself from sort of jumping on the table and going, oh my God, I can't believe this. Oh, this is oh, that's what Jean would say. Oh my God. And I couldn't do any of that, of course.
Yeah.
So I just sort of sat there, you know, like gnawing on my knuckles thinking, oh, I can't believe this. Who can I share this with? And so that was just a kind of funny period, but I knew probably on day one of that program that I was going to write a book. It took me 10 years to write it, but I knew that I had something that, like, neither one of the sides had both.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the focusing people didn't know what I was learning, and the people that I was learning with didn't know focusing, and it was like, oh my goodness, this is unreal. These two things have to go together. And so, I mean, I did a lot more training and supervision and so on, all the time taking notes for a book that I was going to someday write, which is exactly what I did. So that is the long, short story of what happened, and both models are now so woven for me that I can barely separate them. I mean, of course, I can separate them because I teach focusing.
But in
my practice, it's just, it's seamlessly woven now.
So
I know when to go one way, and I know when to go another way, and I know how to weave it. And it's also helpful to know what I know now for people who are not natural focusers, because people who tend to come to focusing workshops, conferences, are interested in that. They have some predisposition to it. They didn't just get there. They have read the book or heard about it or taken a workshop someplace, so they know something. But a lot of the people that I get in my practice don't know any of this. And you can't just say, close your eyes and go down into your body. I mean,
yeah.
It would be like,
so what kinds of things do you say?
Well, normally, for me, I just got stuck because I want to answer this in the right way. The first and foremost thing for me with anybody is connecting. And I don't care what that means. It could be serious. It could be humor. I want them to trust me. I want them to feel when they're in my office like they are in the safest place in the whole universe, that they could tell me anything. So that's the first thing, is the connection. Then the second piece is through dialogue, listening to their stories, reflecting that, kind of getting a sense of how they work naturally. Over time, if I have long-term clients, they eventually all know about focusing. But in a first session, I'm just trying to get, even just through how they speak, are they, to use NLP terms, are they visual? Are they auditory? Are they kinesthetic? Do they sort of put their hand on their stomach when they're talking? Or are they speaking from their heads, which is totally fine. There's a way to check that out in the body without making somebody uncomfortable or saying, you know, don't you know how to do that? Which obviously nobody would do. But so I am just trying to make sure, and I do some, this is a parenthetical aside, I am always doing some psycho-ed as I teach. So it's not uncommon for me to, if I'm asking them how they feel about something that they've said, to point out that I want what they think and what they feel to match. I don't really care if they're thinking first and then checking with their feelings, or checking with their feelings and telling me what they're thinking. But I get them to be aware of, you know, I said that, but I don't think I mean it. That's when I know I'm on the right track, when somebody will say something like that. They've already got, aha, there's not congruence here.
Right, right. So what you do is you establish a climate of safety and trust.
Absolutely.
And, you know, from which there is the possibility of going inside. You also establish connection with them, so that, you know, there is a sense of connection between you and them. And with that safety, trust, and connection, then it becomes much easier to help them notice when there is a discrepancy between what they feel and what they think.
Absolutely. You said it exactly right. And also, with certain people, I will actually say, there's something that I know that I think would be really helpful to you. And it's this process I know called focusing. And would you be willing to read this book for homework? And I've always got the books there. And with that kind of a client, it's because they don't know it at all, but I think it would help them, or I think that they'd be able to do it. And so then they'll go home and they'll read the book, and then they'll come back with questions, and I'll say, well, let's try this, or let's try this. As you rightly pointed out, if the connection is right, they'll try anything. Because they feel trusting. I just never want to seem weird. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, she's into some really strange stuff.
Right.
I never want to be looked at like that. So it's really important to me that the trust thing is so high that if I then say, could we try this thing? Would you be willing to close your eyes or whatever? They go, oh, yeah, sure, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have this doctor that I've worked with on and off for years. He is the most mental person. He knows absolutely nothing, or at least he didn't, about the way we work. He didn't get it. It didn't make sense. There was no language that I could use that resonated for him. Go down into your body. What are you talking about? You know, is this an X-ray or what? I mean, he just totally didn't get it. But over time and with trust, I taught him how to clear space. And for reasons that I do not understand, after all these years, he never can remember the term clearing a space. He comes in and goes, could we do that thing that we do? And I know exactly what he means.
Mm-hmm.
And he loves this. And he loves taking the time to find a place for each thing and sort it out. And then he decides on, you know, what he's working on. But that for him is the highlight.
Mm-hmm.
Which is sort of funny because I started this conversation saying my husband thought
it
took so long. He thought he'd never get into focusing. So everybody's so different, eh?
But yeah, I think that's really what the one of the big points is, how you take people where they are instead of imposing some kind of method.
Right. Right. Exactly. And I think that's just so important. It's about the person. And then, you know, you have this grab bag of things that you know, and you pull out what you think is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think for anybody who's been practicing for a long time, you just wind up doing whatever works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an expression, by the way, in brief therapy. They say, if it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually something that you learn. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. So, there you go.
So, obviously, because of this, all sessions are going to be very different. But just the flavor of one session, you know, just somebody who comes to mind, you've worked with recently, to get a little bit of that sense of that interweaving of focusing and brief therapy. And maybe NLP, and, you know, just some of whatever works.
I'm just going to open my book and see who I worked with last week, who would be just a perfect example of that. Okay, so there is this guy that is, let's see how I can say this. He came from a very critical family, and so his whole thing is hiding. And when I first started working with him, he always had these excuses about why he did what he did, but it was really almost like these intrusive parents kind of going, what are you doing? Why did you do that? And so he was so defensive. I don't think I've ever worked with anybody so defensive. So the first piece obviously was safety. But the second was inviting him to speak, and of course my reflections made an impact as well, to make safety. It took a long time, and it's still not entirely grounded, but he gets that there's how he is when he feels safe and how he is when he doesn't. So I got him tuned in a focusing way to what he's actually feeling about what he sees. He was a perfect example, by the way, of incongruent.
Mm-hmm.
What he said and what he was feeling were so far off, and he didn't even know it. So to shorten the story, when he started feeling more comfortable with that, I would often also integrate solution questions like, when it's better, what will it look like? And have him describe it in minute detail. Or on a scale of 1 to 10, and scale something and then give him homework based on, okay, what will get you from a 5 to a 5.5 by the next time I see you. Scaling is a brief therapy thing that's done all the time. So that's a case where it's very woven. I don't know if I was so clear about that, but
yeah,
it just went in stages from totally unsafe to safe to dealing with the worst incongruence really I've ever seen, saying something and having absolutely no connection with what, like a moving mouth,
mm-hmm.
nobody behind it.
Yeah.
So, and you know what that makes me think of, which isn't a client, but it's a piece that I would love to share.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with focusing and parenting. This came mm-hmm. up in a session yesterday, so that's why it's probably in my mind. You can do so much with young children without even teaching them focusing. That is so natural, of course, to children, but I was sharing with somebody yesterday that I remember when my kid was really young and I would say, do you want apple juice, orange juice, or milk? Now just take a minute and really see what feels like what you want to have. And so I would do things like that all the time. Do you want the red pajamas or the green pajamas?
Hmm.
Just so that she got used to what feels right to me. And by the time she was 4 or 5, I remember saying, would you like a second helping of dessert? And she paused and she said, my mouth says yes, but my tummy says no.
Wow.
Full. And I thought, okay, we're on the right track here.
Wow. Wow.
That to me is maybe one of the most important stories in this whole conversation.
That's very moving. That's very moving.
And it's so easy. You don't say sit down and close your eyes and get a sense of what. It's just empowering. No, you decide.
Yeah.
What do you think?
But
and even if she would come to me with problems, I mean, of course I'd give her feedback and advice, but I would first say, well, what's your sense, or how much, what have you thought about so far? And so it became so normal to just check and see, well, this feels right, or this doesn't feel right. And I remember a little later story, I think this was grade 1, and she had this friend, and she came back, and she said, I'm not going to be friends with her anymore. And I said, why? She said, well, I thought I liked her, but I don't like the way she talks to her mother. That doesn't feel right to me at all, and I don't want to be with anybody who talks to their mother like that.
Mm.
And she stopped being friends with her.
Wow.
Because it obviously had this impact that she could talk so nicely to her friends and be so really obnoxious to her mother.
Mm-hmm. But that's really beautiful, and it ties so nicely with actually that sense and the discussion we had at the beginning about, you know, the rigid observance of the steps and what focusing is and what you do in therapy about creating, you know, that climate of trust and connection. And so this is a perfect example of how, you know, you know, that's creating the atmosphere, transmitting the atmosphere that's conducive to developing focusing as something that's a natural ability of people. And what you're describing with your daughter is really creating a space where you have the interest to welcome her feelings. And as you do that, obviously she's going to feel more comfortable going there because you really welcome them and value them.
Yeah.
So.
It's true. And I just wish the whole world could do that. I don't know that that's going to happen. I wish it did.
Well, you know, maybe it is a bit of a distraction if we go there. We focus on something that's so big, it's daunting. But step by step, it feels nice to do it ourselves and sharing with other people and, you know, keep growing it, doesn't it?
I think you're bang on, and I've actually had to come to terms with that for myself, that I can only... The only way I can change the world is in my own daily living, in my community, with people I interact with, and hope that that rubs off in some way that helps somebody else deal better with their family and their friends and their community or their workplace. But I have no idea how to change the world. I mean, I can just do what I do and hope that it makes some kind of a dent. When I was younger and when I was a hippie, I thought I could change the world, but I can't do that anymore. I can only do it this way.
So, Balam, as a, it seems like a nice way to end the conversation. I just want to check if there's something else you might want to say to end this.
Just that I feel so grateful that this work has come into my life and that I've met the people that I've met and formed the friendships that I have, that I've known Jean Genlin in my lifetime is one of the most special happenings of my life. I think he changed my life in many ways, and I'm deeply indebted. And it's just a pleasure. Whatever I can do in the community to be helpful is just a pleasure. I think we're thinking about the next folio, so that's a little contribution I can possibly make. And I'm delighted. I'm just delighted and grateful, and I feel blessed. So that's where I'll end.
This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.